Welcome to Season 2 of Just Another Lens. I'm your host, Sanjeev Patel. Join me in this safe space as I have conversations with real people, sharing real stories and real insights. On today's episode, I'm joined by Haj Gaily, someone whose life was almost destroyed by a gambling addiction. Tune into this real and raw conversation. Learn how he faced every day, moment to moment, dealing with this addiction, and how he bounced back. So we're living in times of immense strain on humanity. We're living in times of uncertainty. And people are looking for quick fixes, plasters if you like, sticky plasters, to deal with the pain. And quite often that turns to substances. I remember as a young child, these guardrails that my parents gave me, and discussing those with my friends, it would be, yeah, but we know what we're doing. We're not letting this, we're not abusing ourselves. We're doing it socially. And people do that. When the term addiction comes up, it's a big term that can scare people. But it creeps up on you, doesn't it, Haj?
Very much so.
I've got on my show today, Haj Gaily, that I met when I was doing a talk at the Mental Health Awareness event at the House of Commons last May. And Haj was quietly sitting there, taking it all in. But also what I loved about Haj was that genuine desire to make a difference to as many people as he possibly could in whatever way he could. I realized that so many of the people were there because of Haj. And I wanted to do something at that time to showcase what you are as a person and also highlight your journey and how you sharing your journey and continuing to evolve is a way of making a difference in the world. So Haj, thank you so much for joining me today on Just Another Lens.
I think you've portrayed everything so beautifully. And I love what you're saying about, you know, generationally, how we grow up and how we have to conform to a certain extent to generational beliefs or adopted beliefs. And that played a big part in my journey, which I'm sure we're going to open up and cover on today's episode.
Absolutely, Haj. So I'm an immigrant child brought up in Britain, 70s and 80s, trying to find my identity.
Mm.
And that's something I'm sure a lot of people can relate to.
You know? I think that's a big thing which people are struggling with. Just who am I is a question I get asked a lot. Where's my place? Where's my purpose? What am I here for? And I think that is tends to struggle with a lot of people. I'm fortunate where I found my one, but I love that we're even talking about that.
The beautiful part of conversations that I have here in this safe space is there's nothing off limits. And you kindly said, look, ask me whatever you want. And I certainly will. Haj, let's start with your journey of addiction. And then I'm going to go and play the tape right back and go, well, okay, let's look at what were the signals and the messages that perhaps you didn't pick up in your early life.
Yeah.
So Haj, I've seen so many of your videos about what gambling did to you.
Yeah.
In a world where governments are challenged for mollycoddling their citizens and, you know, controlling their thoughts, there's one way of looking at this that says, hey, freedom of choice. Nobody forces somebody to gamble.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with advertising and what's wrong with gaining revenue?
Yeah.
That helps sustain the economy. I know you have some very strong views about that.
Totally agree.
So tell us about your journey of how you got involved in gambling in the first place.
So the first time I actually got into gambling was after I left university. Now, I actually was that typical Indian child that went to university. And just so I didn't let my parents down and I didn't let society down, I did one of the typical Indian degrees, law. And you know the other ones, whether it's medicine, doctor, pharmacy, economics, any one of those.
Engineer, but it has to be these, right?
it has to be one of them.
Exist outside of this, whether you like it or not.
And to be honest, I had no interest in law. I just did it because on paper, that's what I'm told. If you get a good degree, you get a good job, and then you can go on to live a good life. And that's what I've always believed, right? And then so I left university. And even through university, there was something happened in second year, which actually shifted maybe what I thought was who I actually am. And I realized that spending most of your student loan on things that don't serve you was not the right choices. So within a couple of days, I spent all that money. But what happened was, after I left university, I realized law wasn't for me and I started a business.
Okay. Spending your money on what?
Oh, everything from going out, buying clothes. The gambling wasn't part of that time. So, I mean, I was at Life and Soul, the party, and I craved it. I mean, I'll be that first person on the dance floor and the last person off. I'll be the one in your dorm. I'll be up late. I would get FOMO if I wasn't around people or something's happening and I'm not part of that. Because if I missed out, I'm missing out on something crucial. And I've always wanted to be that person.
Hang on. Somebody is living it large. Somebody is life inside of a party. But FOMO, so if you missed out, you missed out on something crucial.
Yeah.
What was that crucial that you could have been missing out on? What could you have missed out on? One more party, one more celebration?
I don't think it's not so much a celebration, and I don't think it's the party. It's the connection someone makes. So, he's made friends with this person, but I want to make a deeper connection with that person.
Okay.
So there was almost like a rivalry between friendships, but the rivalry has come from me because I wanted to be that friend with everyone. I wanted to be that best friend with everyone. I wanted them to confide in me. I didn't want them to confide in anyone else. And I just always had that. And even before that, even from secondary school, I would even go classes back into primary school. I was always that one that wanted to be not just best friends with the cool kids. I was always that friends with the ones that, you know, weren't so much the cool kids. And I just needed to be loved and appreciated. And I needed to be friends with every single person.
I think you've just, for me, listening to you playing that back, that last little bit hits you on the head. You needed to be loved. And then that didn't have any discrimination between status, popularity. What I hear in that is the craving to be loved.
Yeah.
That feeling. And that's what you've craved for, and that's what you, I guess, were addicted to, since that was your driver.
One of the drivers.
Okay.
There's a reason for that.
Please share.
So growing up, so I've come from Punjabi household. So my dad was born in Kenya, came over to England. My mum's from New Delhi, came over to England. And my mum had 4 boys in 5 years. Mad woman. But I had 2 older brothers, 1 younger. But growing up, you know, I think some people may relate to this, especially in the Punjabi culture. There's a big drinking culture. You might have heard it, or you've maybe seen it.
Been around it all my life.
Well, Punjabis are called the Irish of the South Asians.
You said it, not me.
And I'm saying it. So the loud, the brash, the jokers, the big partiers, the big drinkers. And that's all I've ever known growing up around my parents. So much more my dad. My dad was an alcoholic growing up. So when I was a young child, my home looked like this. It looked like me playing with my brothers. My mum would work nights in Asda's. So she would get ready to leave the door about 4:30, 4:45. But my dad would never show up before my mum left.
Okay.
So there was that 15-minute window, half an hour window, where you had these young children by themselves. But my dad would always show up about 5:00 or 5:15. But he always smelled of drink. There was a local shop around the corner. He'd always stop in there, have 1 or 2 beers, then come home. And then you'd always find some more beers, like, wherever it may be, or whiskey bottles, small ones, large ones. And he would pretty much drink himself to sleep, make his own food, or mum has made him food. And there was an incident when I was 8, 9 years old, where me and my brothers are playing outside, and we've just come back in the house, and we could smell this weird, I mean, really weird stench. And we've gone upstairs, because I know my dad's not downstairs, the TV's on, so I know one thing, he's upstairs. So me and my brother went to go check on him. But what happened is I caught my dad on just lying in bed, but he'd vomited everywhere. On the floor, I mean, everywhere. It was on the bed, on himself. And I'm 8 years old trying to clean up after him, me and my oldest brother. And I'm taking his clothes off. I had to pick him up with my brother, take him into the bathroom, clean him up. put him back in bed, changed the bistro, changed the sheets. And I think part of me was saying to myself, this is not my dad. And I lost. And I lost respect for him at that day. And I've never seen him as a dad since that day. He might be there even today as someone that has the label as a dad. But today I don't even recognize him as being my dad. And what that taught me was I had no father figure in my life. And that led on to my older brother maybe stepping into that role. And that's why me and him had lots of fights growing up. You know, I mean, not just blood drawn fights, because he was trying to impose, you know, barriers and boundaries and decisions. I'm like, well, you're not my dad. So who are you to tell me what to do? And then amongst that, you know, my mum's now in survival mode. She's literally trying to look after the house, look after the boys, come back from work, get us ready, take us to school, have a nap, come pick us up from school, you know, make sure food's cooked, making sure the house is all tidy, making sure the bills are paid. So I see my mum as this strong woman, but I've also wanted the love from her.
That's incredibly powerful and touching.
And, yeah.
And what I find really difficult to understand as a father myself is that in our culture, as with many, there's a father figure who is the provider, who's supposed to be the strong person who sets the rules, sets the standard, if you like.
Yeah.
But quite often, even today across cultures, you see family dynamics break down. They're so dominant that effectively it goes away from being principled to just do what I say.
Yeah.
Don't worry about what I do. And for a young child looking for someone to look up to, that father figure, it's immensely powerful and sad that in that moment, having an 8-year-old child walking into a father strewn out across the room, vomit everywhere, that respect of the way that father figure looked, how he'd let himself go, hit you so deeply, so hard, that seemed to be a turning point into that relationship that he's never been able to recoup.
No. Even throughout my journey of growing into a young child, into an adult, I've numerous occasions have asked him to stop, and I've tried various shouting, love, forward, look at your future. Even certain things of just trying to get him to maybe think a little bit differently with some compassion, you know, and I've definitely had that empathy and compassion from such a young age. And I've always tried to look at it through the lens of how can I help you? And I've tried to help him. Unfortunately, he's just never wanted the help. And that's the heartbreaking part. It's even being your father and even a child trying to help you to say that, Dad, look, I'm on your side. I'm here to really put my hand out and take you from this pit where I know you are. But you're not coming up with me.
And what do you think was and it does hold people like your father back from?
Personally, I believe it's that men from that generation, even somewhat today, they've never really been taught how to actually communicate. And here's the reason why, because growing up, if you think about it, from a young age, especially men, and not just from the South Asian culture, but little things like shut up, big boys don't work, you know, big boys don't cry, wear your big boy in pants, all these things that we've been told. So if we've been told this from a young age, what are we doing? We are suppressing that child, and then it's just layering on from childhood into young adulthood. So we're literally suppressing their voice. Then if we're suppressing their voice, we're then suppressing their version of communication. Then it's a case of, now you want me to open up in our relationship. Now I can't open up because I've been told not how to open up. So I think personally is that generation have, and I get the alpha male and providers and working, But that doesn't mean you can't be there for your family. There's a difference between what happens on the outside world and what happens on the internal world. And it's about you going, this is my family. I'm going to provide for them. But also, let me understand them. And the problem is that majority of men from that generation don't even have the understanding to go, maybe I can just find out what's happening with my child.
There's a lot of work I get involved in. One of the biggest areas I think there is for development is emotional intelligence across society. Now, why am I saying that? I can relate to you and your father's relationship to an extent that my father very much was that hardworking individual who didn't have communication skills. He never had. Bless him, I love him to bits.
Yeah.
Sadly, he passed away during COVID, but he was doing the right thing as far as he was concerned.
Yeah.
His tough love was, you know, me and my brother look at this differently. My brother recounts the tough love as my dad could have been kinder. He could have done this. And my dad, at certain points, you know, he did some things and made some choices for us, which, sure, it probably wasn't the best. But from my lens, the lens I've been kind of I've developed in my journey is, where does this come from? Not what is it doing? And I think the way I was able to manage that and still have peace with that and joy with it is that my father was the best he could be from what he knew how to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had conversations through the years and reflective rear view conversations, because in the moment, they're never going to listen. I've been there. But an acceptance that, and he used to say this, and my mum, he'd say, look, we did the best we could. From my response would be, but we can always evolve and learn and reflect.
Yeah.
In other words, sure, I can look back at choices I make with my children. Could I have made different choices? I don't know. But maybe I could, and maybe I can learn, stay connected. But in a culture where there's an alpha male, in a culture where over generations they've had to work really hard to survive, in an environment where they've come to a country where they weren't particularly welcomed.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about it. There was a lot of racism in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up. There was the National Front, which is a large political movement.
Yeah.
Who openly went around blacks, wogs out, Pakis out.
Yeah.
So in the context of that, in no way do I condone what your father said, but perhaps my thinking is, for those who are out there, there's a couple of learnings here. We're talking about that generation, but I see it today as like you do.
Yeah.
That we can get very much sucked into this role that we play in our lives, in our family unit. I'm the breadwinner. You're the person who looks after the kids or the family.
Yeah.
Kids, you have to listen to what I'm doing because you don't know how hard I'm working. But being able to stand back from that and forcing yourself to stand back from that is not just for the benefit of those children, it's for your own benefit.
Yeah. And there's a part of, so the turmoil of my gambling, which is what ultimately where it sort of segued into. But on the other side of it, you know, therapy played a big part, which allowed me to uncover not just aspects of my childhood, but also aspects of me. Because I think as human beings, we can quickly blame parents or siblings or government or the pandemic or inflation rates. But ultimately what we're doing, we're deflecting the real issue. And unfortunately for me, that was a big part of my life. For 12 years of my life, I lived in secrecy. I lived in lies. I lived in an emotional roller coaster that is also known as the hidden addiction. Because unlike other addictions, like alcohol or drugs, you can see when someone's intoxicated, right? But gambling, the way I say this, gambling does not discriminate. It doesn't care about your age. It doesn't care about your ethnicity, your look, your color, your creed. You're even your neurodivergency, wherever it may be, it comes after one thing, which is your worth. And I say that because that also plays a big part in reason why people gamble. So for me, one of the, if I take you back to the very first time of why I actually gambled. So I left university, 2007. 2007, I sort of set up a business, right? And I was like, right, I don't want to do law. I want to go into the entrepreneurship. Because I've always been a bit of a hustler, wheeler and dealer. And I think I've always been that, being from Slough. I've just been, like I said, I've been a people person. I love to communicate. I love to talk. I love to get in there. And I just found my way into business. Because second year after university, I had to quickly think of an idea to recoup the money that I just basically wasted on material things. So I found my way on doing click ad banners. I worked with my auntie's property firm. So where I lost, say, a few thousand pounds on just going out and trying to live the high life, I was now making anything from 50 to 200 pounds a week doing click ad banners.
Awesome.
So I still live that life, but now I've got money coming in every week to do it. And so when I left university, I set up a business, I sold it, which happened by accident. So I set up almost like a Facebook, because I heard about Facebook coming into the UK. So I created this website called Club Gel. Okay. And it was almost like taking your student union clubs and putting them online. And you could actually associate and connect with other students' associations. So you can talk about hockey or football or singing or whatever it may be. And it grew to 65,000 members within a couple of years. I love that because I just had this maybe determination in me to do something different. And I went into a meeting. So I went to a student union fair and I met milkround.com. And I said to him, oh, you know, we have students on our site, why don't you advertise? So we did a couple of runs with them and then it went into a conversation of, well, why don't we purchase your business? And I had investors, so the auntie that actually I was doing the ad for, she actually invested in my business. It's funny how this works, right?
Absolutely.
So I sold the business. I was like, I'm 23 or something at the time. I'm like, I just want to sell the business because I've always grown up, get a good job, be on 30, 40,000 a year, you know, get Mercedes, BMW, Audi, one of the typical German cars, you know, get a nice house, get married. So that in our society, that is deemed as someone as quite successful,
that's
right?
That's success, right?
Yeah. That's success to them. But now I've got more money than I've ever noticed anyone in my family or anyone known around me to have it.
At the age of 23?
At the age of 23.
Wow.
But having said that, I remember my auntie's house in Birmingham. Oh man, it's the first time I've ever really gone behind the scenes and actually seen how the other half live.
Wow.
I remember going in there, a gated driveway, double garages, you know, massive house in a very affluent place in Birmingham. And I'm seeing these kids going to private school. And part of me is like, wow, I want a part of this. I want a piece of this. Obviously, the money I had, it wasn't going to make me that life far, but I just saw that lifestyle. And what happened is after a night out in Birmingham, so with a couple of friends, you know, one of my friends was, once again, we're party animals. Like, let's go out, you know, there's a casino around the corner. You know, they do free drinks, free food at that time. I don't think they do it much now anymore. So we ended up in a casino on Broad Street in Birmingham. And if you've never been to a casino, I'm not sure if you have. Usually what happens is you go to the front bit and the person checks your ID and then there's these double doors. So I did that and I pushed open these double doors and I remember walking through and I just took a moment because it was just a really surreal environment. I'm hearing people talking and people laughing. I can hear the sounds of the croupiers, the roulette machine and the slot machines. I can see the lights. For me, I've always associated casinos to someone like James Bond, right?
Yeah.
So it's almost that upper echelon. Wow, I'm in a place where, is this where the rich and the elites rub shoulders with each other? Well, it couldn't be because I'm bloody in there, right? With my friends. And so I remember going in and I just had this feeling and it's just you almost feel like you're a $1 million. This really larger than life feeling. And I'm having a laugh with my friends. We're playing. And I'm watching them play blackjack. And they're like, Haji, why don't you join us? I'm like, I've never played. They said, look, we'll teach you. Just take out £20, give them to the croupier. He gives you these chips, which are really weird, by the way. And I'm now, they're almost coaching me. Maybe like how you do in your therapy sessions, but they're coaching me on how to gamble. This is a soft 17. This is a blackjack. This is how you double down. You know, this is where you stick. So within 20, 30 minutes, actually 30, 40 minutes, I've turned £20 into about 60, £70. My head's going, this is free, easy money, man. Like, I'm saving a bit of money. Maybe I can keep doing this. Or maybe I just got a taste of that life. And that really sort of carried on. So every other weekend would go out. And then it went from every other weekend to every weekend. Then to every weekend, then we'd go to every other day. But then I realized that I didn't want to go with my friends. I just started going by myself every day into not just one casino. I'll go to multiple casinos because depending on how I felt, how my luck felt on the day, I would change my rhythm or my patterns. And I'm going to talk about that because...
And you believe that your rhythm and your pattern, how you felt,
yeah,
was going to determine how you're going to perform on the day?
Massively. I kid you not. You build like almost like a bit like you going into work. You wake up at a certain time. You treat it like an actual job. I wake up at a certain time. I'm showering. I'm eating my breakfast. Right, if I get into casino this time, I know even what dealer's going to be there. I know the route I'm going to take. I know what they're going to be serving. I know everything.
But this is a game of chance.
You think it's a game of chance.
Okay.
But your mind tells you otherwise.
So my view, it's a game of chance, but your mind tells you otherwise.
Yeah. And I'll tell you why.
The environment is conditioned because something you said right at the beginning of going into the first casino is that you feel $1 million. You feel that these are the people who have achieved everything. And for me, that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
It's a business for them.
100%.
But understanding that reality, that you're being conditioned the moment you step in there to feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And to start thinking a certain way. So sorry, you're saying, so you prepare yourself.
But no, but that you said there, it's, you're so strife on that. It's the conditioning. It's the compounding layer of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. Because if you're one off here and there, it's okay. Let's be honest with you. There are many, many people that enjoy a little flutter or doing a scratch card or a national lottery. They don't have a problem. But when it becomes someone like myself, who's a massive dopamine chaser, who loves that feeling of, wow, could this be the next one? Because the truth is, the money that I had acquired from the company, from the sale, within a year of having all that money, I gambled it all away. And I remember that day, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd just come back from the casino. I'm sitting in my apartment in Birmingham going, how am I going to pay the rent? I don't even have money for food. I don't have money even to go back. Literally nothing. So I just packed my bags up. I got on the train and I had to hide in the toilet because I had no money for the ticket. And I got back home and I remember saying to my parents, look, I've messed up. I've made a few bad decisions. I didn't tell him exactly what, but this is another thing I've seen in our society. So it's, our parents will never question, especially my parents, they never question what I did wrong. But what did they say? Don't worry, everything will work itself out. Perhaps that's not what I wanted.
What did you want?
I wanted someone to take the pain away. Because if you haven't been gripped by what I was going through, it's hard to comprehend what that feels like. And I just, and part of me was, I could see myself in my dad as well. And part of me felt a bit guilty because my mum had experienced it with my dad. And if I told her about it, now she's got potentially two people she's failed as a mother. And that's why I didn't say anything. So for me, I decided to stay quiet. However, I was always very confident in my capabilities. So I said, I'm just going to go back and get a job. And my mind was like, I'm going to go get a job and I'm going to carry on just not gambling. I'm going to make a change in my life. And then when I saw the first paycheck come in, right, this is a recurring paycheck every single month. And I've seen how much I've lost. but I've also seen how much I've won in that time as well. But ultimately, I've lost. So I knew that every month I'm going to get this money. So I'm going to use that to maybe recoup the money that I lost. And then that became pretty much everything I was doing for the next 10 years after that.
Take me back to that time you described, where you describe how you felt your mother might feel. She's been let down by not just your father, but then by you, and that hurt you. So how do you go from that feeling of hurt and guilt about your mother and how she might feel about how you're behaving with this to the next step? Okay, the paycheck's coming and I'm going to carry on doing this.
Yeah. So for me, the only way that I can make it right is to recoup my losses.
That's the point, right?
Yeah.
It's not about the fact that you discarded that feeling that you let her down, but the other part of this conditioning is, okay, I can fix this. I can fix this. I can fix this. And how can I fix it? Turn to that again.
Yeah.
Because you'd seen it. And, you know, gambling, like any addiction, it starts off harmlessly.
Yeah.
You know, I see all these disclaimers on adverts.
Yeah.
You know, gamble in a certain way. Don't gamble more than you can afford to lose. All that kind of stuff. And I think this is...
The most prominent one, which I absolutely... When the fun stops, and if you look at the way... And it's very clever when you look at it from this perspective. When you look at how it's done, when the fun, and they have the fun, bigger, capital, bold, brighter, shinier, glittery, because they want to associate gambling as fun.
It's so true. So in neuroscience, there's various things that we use in coaching and CBT and NLP. Yeah. The brain doesn't go not, doesn't understand not. So the words that we use, and I'm very consciously telling my clients, people I work with, when they say something, yep, I often get them to replay the same thing, different words. And I said, but that's what I mean. I don't know. Mm. Your subconscious doesn't understand that.
Yeah.
Play it like this. And the fact that gambling is designed to be fun and is designed to be an addiction, that dopamine. And so, sure, you can put words on there, but how they're presented, how the disclaimers are presented is all about then selling back to you.
Yeah.
And I want to address this thing, not just on a gambling front, because you said people, you know, drinking.
Yeah.
I'm going to take that head on. As a young child, I feel I was fortunate in that my upbringing involved certain guardrails. My father used to be that guy, along with my other uncles, who'd sneak away and go and have a Guinness.
Yeah, yeah.
But... It was never you guys can't do it. It was always that there's no way you guys are doing this.
Yeah.
But in my young age, I got involved in the spiritual path. I was a guru. Beautiful. Used to go regularly to satsang. And within that, I learned part of our sadhana, our conditioning is abstain from any intoxicants. And I had that self-awareness about my own nature. I says, you know what? If I can get, you know, I had a sweet tooth, but that's an addiction, right? Sugar is a drug. So I knew if I went down the path of just trying it with my friends socially, that there was a risk that I would at some stages sit there and take that as an easy fix.
Yeah.
So that self-awareness. And I'd say that about alcohol as well, my friends.
But here's, so we talk about two different worlds. Remember, your reality gives you a different perception. So for me, my reality would be, I'd be a party and my uncle would be like,
here,
have a little sip.
Have a bit.
Oh, I remember them calling it Danger Coke. Now, as a child, you're telling me that's danger. So what am I going to go and do? I'm going to go towards the danger. I'm a curious child. So I'll sip it. Oh, it tastes a bit warm. But then I've not known what it was. But then you've got your uncles. Like, have a little bit. So I love the fact that you're on that spiritual guy with the satsang and telling you not to be intoxicated and to stay and away from it.
But I had a father who did drink.
Yeah.
I had a father who did smoke. But for me, you're right. The rest of the environment.
Yeah.
And I think that environmental impact, who you surround yourself and what your growing up environment is, what's normalized.
That's the word. What's normalized.
Yeah. And then that, especially in those formative years for a child, impacts everybody. We're all human, right? And I am sure if I was in an environment where alcohol was normalized in social environments, then it's not a judgment on them as people. It's just normalized. But the impact it can have on lives, people don't understand until they've been through it in the reality of it. And thankfully, most people don't. But how many people are suffering in the background? How many people have behaved in a way that they regret, even down to that, because of whatever those addictions, whether it be gambling, alcohol, or anything else. So, you know, I'm very much of in the world that we're in.
Yeah.
Being present in the moment. There's no tomorrow guarantee.
Yeah.
I've lost both my parents like this. There's no guarantee. So living with what you have and enjoying that, tuning that in rather than tuning it out,
yeah,
is a really powerful message that people should take on.
And I love that, because you're giving yourself the grace of having an opportunity to do something different. Because we talk about meaning, right? So let's take money. You know, money has no meaning, but it has a meaning to ones that we attach to it. So for me, my meaning and my attachment to money was what? Gambling. Because it became this ebb and flow, a bit like a relationship, toxic at that, because it serenaded me, it caressed me, it gave me huge elements of oxytocin and dopamine, but also it gave me a lot of cortisol, a lot of stresses. And part of that world was, even if I reflect back on it now, was maybe how I grew up. Mm. It was never a stable life, and I thrived and I lived off this whole premise of, you know, living life on the edge or living life on this turbulent ride, and that's what gambling was doing. You know, going from 20 pound bets to 50 pound bets to 100 pound bets to now a couple hundred pound bets to now 1,000 pound bets. When I talk about the ferocity of the height of my addiction, my typical day would be like, I've woken up. So payday, for an example, I would wake up about 4:30 in the morning because I knew that's when the money would clear into my account. And I knew at that time I'd be maybe paid about £3,500. But I'd always keep maybe £200 aside for the month, for petrol, for food, etc. That would be my living.
Well, hang on a second. That equation, I was thinking £200 a month aside for gambling, but no, £200 a month from the 3.5 for living expenses.
Yeah.
And the rest is for gambling.
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Think of it this way. Most people wake up to go to work, say 6:30, right? That's changed now because of the pandemic. Some people wake up at
10:11
or 8:59 and then go into the other room.
Switch it on, then go back to sleep. But yeah.
So for me, I knew what was happening. So think of it. By the time someone has even woken up to get in the toilet and get ready for work, I've gambled away a month's worth of wages. But in my head, like I said to you, I would keep away £200 because I knew that would keep me alive.
Get you to the next month.
Yeah, alive for the next month.
Okay.
Even to the point, I say petrol, but you know what I used to do? I used to go to Tesco's and, you know, the petrol pump, they only authorise your card for £1, don't they? So I basically authorise a card for £1 and then put the 90 quid in because that would last me my whole month. And then I'd gamble that money away. So I'd always keep falling myself into a deficit, into a minus. Because anything that I could do to keep any amount of money towards gambling, I would do. Like, there'll be times where I'll be up and down, depending on what my win or loss streaks were. I'll be gambling on the way to work on auto spins. So I'll be driving and the machine will be in auto spins on roulette. I should be focused on the road, driving. I'd get to work. I would even book myself into meeting rooms so I can gamble. I would then go on lunch to gamble. But here's the kicker. When I was up, I'd always treat other people to lunch. And when I was going out after work, if I knew I was down, oh, I can't make it. I need to go home, or I've got a bit of work, so let me just carry on with this. But if I was up, man, where everyone's getting treated, everyone's getting drinks, we're going to go out for a meal, you know, I'd be...
And what did that do for you, reflecting back to...
Oh, man, it gave me status. It gave me what I said to you before. It gave me the element of, I'm a somebody, I'm loved, I'm cared, and I'm seen and heard. I'm seen and heard. And that played a lot for my life. And whenever I was gambling, because maybe that was what that money was giving me. It was giving me an opportunity to be around people where I could pamper them so I could be seen and heard.
Yeah, that's incredibly insightful and connects the dots from your teenage years, your university years,
yeah,
when you were the life and soul who'd make sure he'd be at everything, you know, that FOMO. Yeah. But it's tuning back into, you want to be seen and heard. You want to feel that love. You want to feel that value of,
yeah,
actually I am something, rather than just discounted.
But we talk about love, right? So I met my wife during my addicted years, but I hid it from her. I met her on a flight back from New York in 2012. I was in Vegas before I met this. I flew from Vegas, had a stopover in New York, and met her on the flight back. And within the first couple of dates, I knew, we both, yeah, you're mine, I'm yours. We just knew that was the relationship. So you could call it love was in the air.
Beautiful.
It was written in Gizmoth. And for me, what happened was we got married in 2014, but through these years, she was actually the person that showed me love. But if this is a person that's actually shown me love, why do I still feel a missing void? And part of me was, I'm scared that this person is also taking my other love away, my love for gambling.
It's interesting you describe gambling as your love, not your addiction. And you found this beautiful love. Sounds like for the first time in your life, somebody who loved you for you.
Mm.
But then part of you is hiding some part of you.
Yeah.
Which you don't want to let go of. Yeah. Or you're addicted to and you want to hang on to.
Yeah. So logically, it's telling me to run for the hills. You have someone here. Emotionally, perhaps it's an emotional investment. Because remember, it's been part of my life for so many years now. I'm invested into that relationship, not just financially, but emotionally too. I referred to gambling as a hidden mistress to a certain extent.
I was just thinking that, your other woman.
Yeah, my other woman. And that's how I always classed it. You know, we've shot a film recently and I was talking to the lead actor. I go, imagine gambling being your hidden mistress that you're paying for, you're hiding, the secrecy on the phones. That's exactly how, if you could think and put yourself in that shoe, that's what it felt like. Anything that I could do to cover that life. Because be honest with you, people on the outset, they would see, well, Hodge is quote unquote successful, right? I'm in a great job. I'm earning nearly 100 grand a year. I'm flying around the world in private jets because I work for a private jet company. I also work for the royal family. You know, I was in these places where someone go, you're doing flipping well. You know, I met my wife. You know, I had my first child, Jeevan, in 2017, Boxing Day. So someone would look at it and go, wow, man, you should be blessed. But what people wouldn't see, if you've ever seen Stranger Things on Netflix, you see the upside world and you see the downside world. But no one saw that downward world, which was the stresses, the anxiety, the sleepless nights, the eating disorders, the sleeping disorders, what I was hiding from everyone, which not only was my toxic relationship, but also became my coping mechanism as well. Because it's the only place that I could turn off from the world and be truly me.
The only place that you could turn off and be truly you. Gambling. I'm going to ask you this, and apologies if this is out of bounds, because I know you how much you love your wife and your son. What were you missing now looking back? What were you missing in your thinking that you didn't feel you could be you, truly you, as you put it, with your wife?
The lack of significance. I don't think I was significant enough to be loved by a human being.
So your own lack of self-worth, or how you felt that you were?
My own my lack of significance. Because the truth is, I've never really been loved by anyone. Yet, I had someone that loved me. And I was putting the blinkers on and blindsiding myself not to feel that, because I'd put such a guard up for such a long time. I built up such a guard. And perhaps that's what my mum built up as well. And I just couldn't. I couldn't physically and emotionally put myself in a place where, no matter how much gambling I was doing, it still wasn't fulfilling me. So no matter how much I went down that rabbit hole, no matter how much I put myself into debt, no matter how much I lied and also drunk myself, I still wasn't getting it from there. I wasn't getting it from here. So I'm now torn in between two worlds. And I don't know who I am. So I talk about identity. I didn't know who I was.
There's this big vacuum that I hear in being loved. For me, I talk about the essence of humans. Being human. And part of the essence is to love and feel loved.
Yeah.
That's what ultimately a sense of feeling of belonging, of being just you and being loved for being you, yeah, what's and all, and being in a safe space. And part of what you're saying, I'm getting the sense of, as much as you loved your wife, that insecurity in revealing who you were, that vulnerable person who had these doubts, who had these flaws, revealing that to your wife was probably, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like you didn't feel safe enough to do that because of what that might mean.
Yeah, true. And because I built such a beautiful relationship with my wife, she was with me through other things that are happening with relationship with brothers or family members. So you have this rock who's stuck by you, and part of you feels now guilt that, damn, you've been through thick and thin with me, but yet I'm keeping this whole world a secret from you. And I feared, the truth is, I feared that if she found out that I no longer have that person in my life, I don't have that pillar, I don't have that rock in my life. And this is the truth. I know that there were times I would want to open up to people, but I could see that if I opened up, would they understand it? Would they judge me? Would they talk to me? Would I lose that family? Would I lose that connection? Would I lose that relationship? Would they then talk bad about me? But then would society talk bad about me? So all of these things I'm building as a ladder and ladder, and I'm constantly building the steps up. I knew and I saw what it would potentially lead on to. So rather than walking that path, it's easier for me to stay shut up, and tell my mind to shut up, and be in a place where actually I'll just carry on as is.
Yeah. You know that, just from my experience, Hajj, that is something that so many people are going through, but they're still invisible. You know, yeah. I talk about, we all wear a mask in different roles in our lives. And so many people are in that position where they can't, you know, nobody's perfect. We all have to learn, right? How do we learn from life? We learn from making mistakes. But we're society. I'll say it.
Yeah.
Society builds you up. But the weight of that building you up and playing that role becomes then a load that then we have to constantly strive to be that perfect gloss.
Yeah.
And some of the wisdoms that we see flying around are so simple, but so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, later in life, you realize nobody's talking about you. Nobody's got time to really worry about what you're doing. Sure, there might be a conversation, but then they've got busy lives and they've got other things to deal with. But the weight that we carry as human beings, as individuals, that if I'm seen to be weak, if I've made a mistake, and yeah, it can be a mistake. It can be something that you do not believe that you feel like against your values, but we're human.
Yeah.
And circumstance can lead us to fail. to not live up to their standards, but being okay with that and going, you know what? Part of being human, and society needs to learn this. And more people in our, I would say in society who are successful, need to open up and say, look, because if they can open up and say, look, it's okay. There's no judgments. Take the judgment away. It's just, what can we do to help? Change the perspective. How can we help and support somebody, people around us, to then come out of this trauma?
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Like I said, Anna, I love that we could get to where that was about. It was about, look, this wife that you loved, who supported you, hiding it from her and having this other thing going there is because it wasn't particularly giving you anything, but it was keeping you going.
Yeah.
It was experiencing all of the negative aspects of your nature because you could just be that. And what's the worst going to happen? Yeah, okay, so I lost some money and I'll keep doing this and I know what I'm doing. But it's a hidden fix in there for that gap. Now, in this...
I was going to say, you touched on something really powerful here as well, because we're all wearing masks. The difference here is that I was able to quickly switch the masks when I need to do it seamlessly. So for an example, there's one time at work, I was on a bit of a streak and I thought, you know what? I've turned this into X amount, I've turned that into X amount. Maybe if I turn that into another bit amount. So I went into the toilet at work. Within 20 minutes, I gambled away £9,000. Yet you have this moment of sheer anger. I mean, sheer anger, ferocity, and the internal self-dialogue, the way you talk to yourself, the way you speak to yourself, you wouldn't even wish this upon your worst enemy. But yet it's okay to do it to yourself. But then you're like, right, I'm done. I've had my self-wallowing and self-pity, if you want to call it that. I'm going to go put my mask back on and walk out into a workplace where no one has an inkling that I've just gone and just gambled away £9,000 in 20 minutes. And I have to carry on as happy, smiley Hodge, carrying with a work day, carrying like nothing has happened. So I was quick to change those masks because for so many years, I was a lover, I was a warrior, I was that person, I was a confider. And I was quickly able to change that mask because I became so proficient at changing that mask. And those masks also came with lies. And I don't care what you say, but there's only so much you can lie. And when your wife is questioning you, like, what's this debt letter? What's this bailiff letter? Why are we not going out? There'll be times where we knew that we're meeting with friends, but I'd make some, oh, I've got to work late, or I've got to do this, because I knew that money, we didn't have it, or I'd gambled it away. So I'd hide that and I'll try to distract from that, saying, well, let's stay in this place and let's try and cover up. And everything of this compounding of layering and lying and like you said, this hidden mistress. My wife had a gut intuition, and that gut intuition became real on 16th of June 2020.
Talk us through that day. What happened?
So June 2020, we're in the middle of what? A pandemic. But we had beautiful weather that morning. I remember this so vividly, like it is yesterday. I'd come out the shower and it was beautiful, sunny morning, still warm, about 8 o'clock. And my son Jeevan was playing in his room. And I always love making coffee in the morning. I just love that. I'm a coffee person. Had one before I came here. And I could smell the coffee and I'm walking to my bedroom. And I remember just my wife sitting on the bed, but this time crying. And I've never seen her cry in this emotional state, bawling out, crying. And as a husband, I'm like, what's happened? Like, what's wrong? Tell me what's gone on. But then I noticed the phone in her hand and my heart dropped to my stomach like that. And it didn't become, what's wrong with you? I became scared. Mm. And I was like, what has she found out? Because what I realized was it was my phone in her hand. And when I said, what's wrong? Because my tone had changed, everything about me changed. And I remember it being a warm morning, but yet it felt so cold. It almost felt like gray in that room. And then she just looked up at me with these eyes of pure, unfiltered disappointment, heartbreak, And she said to me, I can't believe you've done this to us. You said to me when we first met, you're never going to break my heart. You're never going to break promises. I'm always going to be able to trust you. And then there was black and white. She accessed my online bank account. Transactions after transactions after transactions after transactions. Scrolling. Hundreds, 500, thousands. Gambled away. I had nowhere to run. What could I say? A friend told me this was going on. But part of me was like, you're done running. And I actually said to myself in my head, you are done now. This is it. Give it up. And this thing came in my head, which is, you've heard it, right? If you speak your truth, it should set you free, right? And it did. But what they don't teach you is in come the floodgates of guilt. So whilst I felt a big sigh of relief, actually I felt a heavier boulder of burden come through with guilt, because I've broken the fundamental trust of any relationship. Trust. And we had this conversation. I mean, yeah, it was turmoil. It was disruptive. From her. And she had every right. I stayed quiet. And I'm a talker. At that moment, I just kept quiet because I had nothing to say.
Now put yourself back to your childhood and your mother consistently finding your father in that state. How much of that disappointment, that realization that this is not who you are, this is who you really are, how much of that connected between how your wife responded then, that feeling of, you've let me down, you've broken our trust, you're not who you said you were?
If I'm honest with you, at that time, it didn't even register. Because I was my emotions were ping-ponging between so many different factors. And my stress levels and my thought, I'm in panic mode. I'm trying to save my marriage. I've now been told, I'm leaving you. I'm taking my kid. And also, we just found out that my wife's also pregnant with our second child. So I'm finding all this out. And my whole aim is to beg, keep her with me. And can I tell you what did hit me that day?
Go for it.
I remember after that, she'd ran out of the room. And she's downstairs because we were living with my in-laws at the time. And I remember I'm just sitting on the bed. I'm having this moment to myself going, Hard, you absolute fucking idiot. And this moment just clicked me, go, you've been trying to chase a jackpot. Yeah, it sat right in front of you. But yet you're so stupid and so blinded by this other world that you didn't even see it. And that was when it really hit me. And that was, I need to do something. And then even before I was even thinking about what that was, my wife came up and she goes, I've spoken to your mum. And, right, have your moment with your child. Have your moment with your child is what? I'm never going to see him again. So I'm gearing up to let it all go. But in the moment, I'm not really present with my son, because I'm thinking to myself, how have I let him down so much? How have I let myself down so much? And I'm processing all these emotions as of a failure. And you're right. That's when I thought, I'm like my dad. It didn't really register, but I'd said, I'm exactly like my dad. And that thought took me to deeper depths.
So tell me where it took you and what happened after that. So here's your wife saying she's going to walk out with you.
So my wife came back up and said, she gave me a glint of hope. She said, if our marriage is to work, and that's all I heard, if our marriage is to work, right, I've got an opportunity here. You're going to have to get professional help. So who am I going to call? My brothers, my family? You already spoke to my mum. I can't go there. So I reached out to my local temple and they said, well, we can't help you. So the place that we've been told to go and seek help and support can't even help me. And I felt more judged coming off that call than any other place before. So then I remember picking up the phone. I called GamCare. I Googled, called GamCare, because I've made a commitment to my wife. I'm going to hold true on this. And half an hour, someone just said to me, how can I help you? But it's the one time that I didn't feel judged and someone openly was asking about who I truly am and what I truly needed help with. Unfortunately, because of the whole system, I had to go with NHS. And remember, I can't meet you in person. It's all online. I'm in group therapy, not single. So I'm now opening up to people that I don't even know. So what happened is months have rolled by. So from June, it was into about August. I haven't got a job. Now I'm trying to start a business because that's the only way I can try and make money. Because now I've tried to, remember, I had to go through an exercise with my wife going, £1,000, £5,000, £10,000, £100,000. I remember going, when is it flipping going to stop? To the tune of debt of £250,000. That's how much debt I was in because of gambling. So not only am I have to rebuild my marriage, I have to try and find a way of rebuilding that debt. I have to rebuild trust. I have to try and make money. I have to try and get therapy and get better. And I was on my way back from Nottingham on the 18th of August, 2020. Things weren't going well. I was at the deepest point I could ever be in my life. I had these conversational thoughts in my head. Remember, you're like your dad. You're a failure. You're not worthy of this life. You're not worthy of your family. You're in debt. Like, what type of woman, what type of person are you that puts your family through this? I mean, there's deeper thoughts. The fact that is, your child will never look up to you and see you as a dad. Those are the thoughts I'm having in my head. And I saw what it's going to take to come out of that hole. And I knew what needs to be done. And I thought it's easier if I called it quits. So I'm on the M1, Leicester services. I was doing about 80, 85 on the road. I took my seatbelt off. And I just let go of the car. And I remember, bang, hit the Central Reserve. And I blacked out. And there's this moment where I woke, or was I awake? Am I dead? Am I alive? I don't care. But then my senses kicked in. The smoke kicked in. Then I realized what happened, and then the panic kicked in. And I had the machine talking to me saying, do you need help? I was like, call everyone. And I'm just in the state. Even to a point of panic, I'm trying to start the car. I'm trying to get away from the scene. I can't do anything. The car is absolutely mangled. It's totaled. Smashing the door open. I fell out. I can smell the smoke. I can feel the panic. I can kick the anxiety. And I fell out the car and I just vomited everywhere because the sheer adrenaline that kicked in. But yeah, I remember having an out of body going, am I really here? Am I actually alive? Because I wanted to be dead. And part of me was angry that I wasn't dead if I was alive. And I'm in the car stopping and saying to me, are you okay? You've been in an accident. I remember the paramedic turning up, speaking to me, go, where's the driver? I'm the driver. They looked at the car, looked at me, and go, Mr. Garley, if you don't believe in a higher power or God or universe or spirit, whatever you want to call it, you better start believing, because you're walking out of that without any broken bones, a few scratches on your face, a few bumps here and there. And you know what? That still didn't hit me. It still didn't register. Am I lucky? Is it a sign for the universe? Don't know. But where it did change was 2 days after, 20th of August, 2020. I'm with my son, Jeevan. And I think the whole overwhelm of what happened, the conversations. And by the way, my wife didn't even know what I did. I didn't tell her because we had two miscarriages beforehand. And I couldn't tell her the truth because I knew that how much stress it would cause. And I couldn't fear or couldn't face another loss. So I kept that from her until after. And then I remember this old sense of overwhelm. I'm like, with my son, I just took my son. I said, let's go. I'm in my wife's car and I'm just driving around with her. Madness. I've just been in a car accident. I'm jumping in another car. I'm driving around. And I'm with my son, Jeevan. And we went into a McDonald's because he wanted some chips. And that was the moment everything changed. I'm in the drive-through. I've ordered some chips. Not even a Happy Meal. just chip French fries. And I remember going to the lady that served me, and I'm son's sitting over here. And I remember this. He just took this chip out and he took a bite, and it was this thing that he's, it wasn't so much what he said, it's this emotional connection we had. And I remember that moment is I realized the true meaning of dependency and responsibility. I had dependents. I had people in my life that I have responsibility for. Because I was so selfish for so many years of my life, I didn't understand that. And it's ironic that my son's name is Jeevan.
Which means?
Life. Bringer of life. He actually said,
your son Jeevan saved your life. You know, Hajj, so much of who you've described as the Hajj that everybody could knew up until that moment was this confident, successful, outgoing guy who was larger than life.
Yeah.
Who had all the trappings of success, who had respect. But behind that, you were living a lie. And I worry when I speak to some people or,
yeah,
you know, see the lives that they're leading. Amazing people who have got caught up in the chase.
Yeah.
You know, because society teaches us, right? Our conditioning teaches us success means this. So, like you said, in our situation, this degree, this job, status, yeah, it brings you status. You get a house, you get, yeah, a home, wife, children, all of that. We forget to be human. We forget to live each day and appreciating the little things in life. And yeah, because we're so busy building up this image, I see that we then have to then maintain it.
Yeah.
And where we're suffering, because it's okay. Life isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Relationships break down. You don't have to pretend.
Yeah.
We make mistakes. We turn to things that can be a quick fix. We don't have to be proud of them, to acknowledge them and take a step back. For me, it's taking a step back is so important.
Yeah.
And having a safe space to do that, where you're not judged.
Yeah.
I've come to a stage where I don't believe there's a specific right or wrong. It all depends.
Yeah.
There are guardrails. There are things that our ancestors, our wise people across the world, whichever philosophy you believe in, or none.
Yeah.
There are guardrails that are there, but it's easy to ignore the guardrails. But it's only so long that you could keep going before they, yeah, have their impact on you. We're all susceptible. It's like I used to say to my kids, talk about, you know, why we don't drink. And I can go down all the spiritual, philosophical way. But very simply, I just keep it like this, that being clear of mind and being in control of your mind is the most powerful place to be in every moment. Life, yeah, will give you curveballs, but if you can condition yourself to navigate that, then you're in a strong position to navigate life and enjoy life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, being accepting that we're human. So
yeah, yeah,
it's nothing's too bad.
Well, do you know what? I would consider myself as one of the fortunate ones, not just because of the attempt on my own life, is because now I walk with purpose.
There you go. All of that has come together. No, the weight of your father's,
yeah,
not being a father. How that you've carried that for a long time is very clear in our conversation today. But being able to get it wrong, because I'm going to say, yeah, you got it wrong, you're in denial. But then trying to use all of that learning to now have a clarity of purpose, and that purpose gives you meaning.
Yeah.
And that's such a powerful message, which I think everybody can get. It doesn't have to be to do with addiction. I talk a lot about volunteering and giving back. And that doesn't have to be in a grand public way.
No.
But the sense of doing something selflessly for somebody,
yeah,
each day has its own power. And for where you are in your journey, I think there's a lot of power in there, because you talk about a culture and environment where being the alpha male,
yeah, yeah,
getting drunk is normal.
Well, look, think of, so 5th of October 21, I went out to the world. I'm Hajj Ghali. I'm a recovering gambling addict. This is my story. I did that because I knew, me being who I was and me being in casinos, I knew there were many other people out there like me that are suffering in silence. And I knew that in the South Asian community, whilst we don't gamble as much as the white ethnicity group, we're four times more likely to suffer the severe consequences of gambling. And if I can be proactive as opposed to reactive, I can share my story, become a beacon of hope, but yet have representation relatability where they go, ah, he looks like me, or he's my color, he understands me, he might understand my culture. In 2024, this was the massive catapult. So from 21, I'll share my journey. I share every day something about my journey, something about my life, something about what you can do. Not only have I been helping people, so last year alone, I helped about nearly 100 people start the recovery journey, whether it's the person struggling with addiction and not just gambling. You know, I'm talking about drugs, I'm talking about alcohol, I'm talking about self-esteem, confidence. The three core ones in South Asians are typically drugs, alcohol, and gambling. The core three addictions, which is why even this year I set up a charity. And the reason I've done that and the reason I'm doing this is because I, like you talk about the word, seva. See, I've been blessed with Maharaja's hukam. I'm here to do something different. I'm here to have a legacy. I'm here to serve faith. And if I can do that through the power of my story, through the power of healing, through the power of therapy, and the power of openness, then guess what? I'm living my purpose. And that's all I do every single day. I get to say to myself, every day above the ground is a blessing. Everything I've been through is a lesson and blessing, because I now get to help and heal. There's a fantastic quote by Brené Brown. One day you will share your story and that story will become someone else's survival guide. And that changed everything for me. So this year I'm setting up the charity called Sochcare.
Do you want to explain what Sochcare means?
So Sochcare, as growing up as Indians, we've always been told Sochcare Kari, yeah, or Sochcare Karo, like to think. And what we're telling is give ourselves grace and pause, mindfulness, openness, just to take a step. Take a beat. But when I saw the word of care, I just changed it to care. So Soch Care. And that means that I want people to have a state of mind where they can have mindfulness, they can have openness, and they can connect their mind, heart, and soul.
Beautiful.
And I can do that by helping people through addictions. I know my strengths because I've seen other charities out there and they're doing fantastic work. I just feel that it's a little bit siloed. And I want this to be therapy that's culturally aligned. So if you can't speak English, well, we've got Gujarati speakers, we've got Hindi speakers, we've got Muslim speakers, Arabic speakers, Somali speakers. I've really been speaking to people in India, Canada, Australia, America about taking this global, but I've got to focus on home first. So Sortcare has been formed this year. And I've already been... So this year alone, I've stopped two people from attempting suicide. I've spoken to nearly 25 people so far this year through those array of addictions. And when you talk about addictions, the biggest thing I found a struggle with is how do I have something that supersedes that need that I was getting from gambling? Well, guess what? God has given me that gift and he's given me the gift of helping and healing. And I get to do that on a daily basis.
Haj, that brings us to a really beautiful point where your life has been shaped by the environment that you're brought up in. Having a family environment where you didn't have a father figure, really. You had clearly an environment where your mother was being strong, resilient, courageous, and doing the best she could, while your father was this big disappointment. That father you...
He was pleaded, a disappointment.
He was. That perfect past tense, right? And we talk about how to heal those relationships as well. Because, as I said to you, in every situation, as you've experienced and displayed for yourself, there's always context.
Yeah.
And so being able to forgive and let go is part of everybody's journey. I think is something that, however far you are down that journey, that path,
yeah,
with whichever relationships, accepting the love that was there, even if it wasn't the love that you wanted and needed,
yeah,
which allows you then to focus and concentrate on the present,
yeah,
and be the father that you know,
yeah,
you would have loved to have had. A lot of people will relate to that. Go on.
You said the word forgive, and I had a struggle with that word forgive for my dad. And it's not that I don't forgive him. What I did do, and which really helped me shape that relationship differently, was I thanked him.
Even more powerful.
Yeah. I thanked him for being him. I thanked him for his contribution. I thanked him for his lessons. I thanked him for him showing me a version of myself. So I found more power and healing through thanking as opposed to forgiving. Now, each and everyone's different. But no, I found solace in that.
No, I genuinely feel that that actually is an even more powerful place to be. I think it's where people go on that journey from getting to that freedom. And we hear across the world, different cultures talking about having gratitude each day. And that every experience in life can be a moment or an experience of learning, however painful it may be through that experience. And if we can learn to look at the world, our lives in that sense, at the same time accept that we are human, so there will be setbacks.
Of course.
There will be days when we're not feeling it,
that
we have not been the best version of ourselves, but being kind to ourselves, compassionate. And one thing that you're on a journey of and you're doing is you've learned to accept yourself and love yourself to be then open and vulnerable about who you are.
Yeah.
And realize and experience that people can relate to that because we're all human.
Yeah.
This is the sort of thing we need leaders to do. And the fact that you're doing this is amazing and incredible.
Yeah.
And I want to wish you all the success. I'm sure that you're destined for it. And as I said to you, from that quiet person sitting in the House of Commons when I was speaking and doing my bit on mental health awareness in the UK, watching how after that you were speaking to every single person and you're genuine, you have a natural gift to connect with people. You've had that from a young age, as we can now learn, but also that desire to make a difference. And I'm sure that the universe will connect the dots and, you know, in whichever way this podcast and whatever I can do to help that journey, it'd be wonderful to see.
Now, and I like I said, it is a beautiful place. And when everyone talks about this journey, you know, we're shooting the film Terminal and we had the premiere on it yesterday, and it's a short film, 10 minutes. But sometimes it's hard to grasp what that person's going through. So by having this, it's not just a short film. It's also a therapy. It's also a tool which can be used to go, right, perhaps you can maybe wear the shoe on the other foot and see what it's like for me. It can be something that can be watched with parents, your siblings or partners. That's me.
So let's go back to that, because I'd like to cover that actually.
Yeah.
So Haj, you've told me about a short movie that you've been integral in shaping and forming and being part of. So tell us a little bit about how that came about, who's involved and where we are with that.
So August 24, Jaz Singh Deol reached out to me on Instagram, who's actor, writer, producer, also played Kirit Panesar on EastEnders. And he was doing a short film with a director called Sunny Bahia, who is actually, the film's based on his lived experience.
Okay.
And he's been writing it since 2017, 2018, but he couldn't get it right. And then when Jaz reached out to me, he said, oh, can I chat to you about your experience? Pretty much. The next day we met up and spoke for 7 hours. That wasn't enough. So we met up the day after for another 7 hours. So 14 hours in total. But then since then, you know, he wanted to really get beyond the person that we see in front and go, what? So he really picked up on the little nuances. Like when you're playing, because obviously this Terminal, the film, it's how someone into bookmakers and got seduced and fell into the world of gambling on the FOBTs, which is the fixed odds betting terminals. So really, you know, we talk about patterns. So what were the patterns? What were you doing? You know, like putting my wallet in a certain way, putting my phone in a certain way, how you would crest the machine, how you'd walk, all these little nuances. And he really took on that. Because like I said, it was easy for me to explain and teach him my experiences. But Jaz, I mean, kudos to him. the way he embodied that role and really managed to capture the ferocity, the intensity, you almost sit there trying to catch a break. Because that's what someone with an addiction also feels like. It's like, let me catch a break and a breath for a minute. But the film doesn't allow you to do so. But it takes you on this journey. And the way it sort of ends, it's so beautiful because it allows the viewer to take their own interpretation of what they feel needs to be next.
So where can we watch this?
So at the moment, it's doing its film festivals. So it's going around. So hopefully we're looking to launch it towards the middle or end of the year. Unfortunately, that's how the film festival work. I didn't realize that. And but as soon as it's out, I'll obviously be publishing it on my socials. I'll be putting it out there. I'll also share it with you as well. So hopefully you can share it too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And once it's out, I'm looking forward to it because it'll be a timeless thing. And the way it's shot, it doesn't matter if you watch it in 20 years, it'll still be as present as it is today.
That's fantastic. I'd like to finish off with some lessons or advice from yourself. So a lot of young people out there are being presented with social media that presents happiness, success in a certain way.
Yes.
And part of your journey and your journey to addiction, it may not have been social media, but this need to be a certain way was driving it. So what advice would you give young people today, or anybody for that matter, who is exposed to social media and success means this, and this is what life can be?
Okay. So I talked about this quite recently, and I'm so glad you talk about this. And the reason I'm speaking about this is because 27% of 11 to 17 year olds have gambled with their own money in the last year.
Wow.
That's a lot. I think it's 95 or 97% of those children have been exposed to gambling through social media. But if we look at social media, there's something called parasocial relationships.
Okay.
And that is called celebrities. That's called influencers. That's called streamers. So if you're a young child watching this or you're a parent watching this, I want you to ask yourself this very simple yet powerful question. Is what is it that you see in this celebrity or influencer that connects you with him? Because the truth is that influencer doesn't care about you, that doesn't acknowledge you, that doesn't even know you. So if you can look closer to home, what you'll find is that someone in your remit is going to give you that. And what I mean by that is yourself, you can give yourself that if you allow you to ask yourself the question. So what I would encourage parents to do is be careful what they're doing at home, because children watch what their parents do. Also, just have an open conversation without any judgment. Let them know, because if you try to hide it from them, they're only going to do the same thing. So get them to understand what the dangers could be, what certain things could happen off the back of it. And through that education, it will allow the child to have informed decisions. So educate yourself, educate your children, but ask the children, what is it that, like I was, what was I missing internally that gambling or something else gave me? Like I said, the need for love. If that is the need for love, where else can I find that? First, where can I find it internally? And then who can I find it with around me?
There are a couple of things that whilst you're talking, and we're talking about young people and creating that open conversation.
Yeah.
One of the things that we adopted, and it was a message from my guru, Pramod Sai Maharaj, to do something called Ghar Sabha. Family get together each day. And it's like, the message is so powerful and it's simple. It's finding a space in each day, whether it's 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you sit and dine together, whatever, but where every member of the family, the household, is sitting there.
Yeah.
But putting their status aside. I'm not dad anymore. Yeah, you speak to each other with respect, but in an open conversation to understand what's happening in each other's world. And what that has seen and proven to do for countless people around the world is break those silos within the household, because I think the world now is faced with the challenge that we, even in a household of having many people, they're actually not communicating so well because they're communicating with their devices and people virtually. So creating that time where we put aside the phones.
Yeah.
They're not even on the table. Ideally, shove them in a drawer.
Yeah.
Create that space. So then what else would you have to do with your time? And talk. And do it in a way where it's safe and it's, you know, it's the responsibility of the elders, I guess, to own that journey and say, look, whatever you say, whatever you've done, it's okay. And get to understand what's driving each other. And for the parents as well, parents can open up and say, this is what's going on. It's okay. Your kids can handle it.
Yeah.
It's better you open up and share that rather than thinking you're protecting them and let that bottle up and come out in a different way.
Yeah.
Could be alcohol, could be anything. Could be violence in some cases.
Yeah.
So that's a really, you know, powerful thing that you're talking about in creating space and conversations.
Do you know what we do with our son Jeevan? He's a bit older, he's 7. He actually journals. And it's we just asked him, you know, write down, and we got a little journal book for him, and at first he wasn't sure about it. So sometimes before he gets to bed, he always writes before bed. And I forgot to, so he sometimes would skip a bit and go and write something down. And sometimes there's some children, if remember, phones can also create a lot of introverts. So what I learned through my power of journaling is that it helps you uncover hidden secrets that you dig deep within. And sometimes, and I asked Jeevan, I go, do you mind if I read it? Sometimes he said no, sometimes he says yes. If I say yes, then I encourage maybe like a deeper thought. So you said that you had a great time with Axel, for an example. What was it specifically that you loved about that? Or you didn't, and I asked him, what did you like and what you didn't like? And that, I mean, honestly, his, you talk about emotional intelligence. This is how we form the next future generation of leaders, is by getting them to tune in to different emotional variances and frequencies where they can catch themselves with the tools and resources that they're built within. That is, sir, called generational wealth.
I love it. I love it. Haji, it's been lovely talking to you. We've covered a whole journey and an emotional journey, clearly.
Thank you.
I think we've talked not just on gambling, but normalization. Now, gambling happens to be your journey, but I think we have to accept that anything that can create an addiction, and I put social media in there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Society normalizes certain behaviors, and each of us have our own free will choice to do what we want. But standing back from time to time, saying, well, am I controlling it or is it controlling me?
Mm.
That kind of question is really important, and a dynamic in a household, a healthy relationship, as you've said. Somewhere along the line, you have to break that, the unsaid, unspoken, to be vulnerable, because in my view, Haj, carrying that around forever is unhealthy, not just for the relationship, but you know, you could end yourself caring so much that you want to end it all like you nearly did.
Yeah.
So to everybody out there who's listened, who's tuned in, I'm sure there'll be plenty that they've picked up, and I hope they'll be able to comment, share, like, and follow the rest of this journey with both of us and see how we can change the world one conversation at a time, one day at a time.
And if anyone watches this and it's themselves that are struggling or someone that they know and love is struggling, remember, conversations cost nothing, but they can cost you everything. So all I ask is that reach out. I've created a space where there's no judgment. It's safe, where you feel heard, you feel seen. But more importantly, you get support.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Haj.
Thank you for having me, man.